Every year at Christmas, we do something that we hope you guys will notice. And this year, we have the scroll, and I hope you've noticed that the words change every week, because it's quite an ordeal to take that thing down and change those words. So we do hope it's recognized. And every week, it's lyrics of a different Christmas song. I don't know if one of your favorite songs, you've seen some of the lyrics up there or at Christmas time at our Christmas concert that we had or with the kids, if any of your favorite Christmas carols have been sung yet. But the one on the scroll today is from Joy to the World. I don't know if that's anyone's favorite song. But in the song Joy to the World by Isaac Watts is this lyric: "In heaven and nature sing." If I say it, you probably hear it in your head. But it's an interesting question. Do they? Does heaven in nature sing? Just thinking about that lyric and about Advent and that question, that's a good question, an important question, I think, to think through. You know, in the 1700s, there developed a skepticism. And they would answer, "Nah, heaven and nature don't sing." And there was this man that he was kind of shook by the skepticism that he was hearing, and he wanted to try to provide an answer. His name was Immanuel Kant, and his path to try to find an answer was through reason. And whether you agree with his conclusions or his attempts, that's a question for another day. But he certainly was influential. And in fact, on his grave in Russia is a quote that he had in two languages, German and Russian. I don't know if you can read it, but it was one of these kind of quotes, and the reason it's on his gravestone is because it's kind of one of those things that took the direction of where he was going. In spite of all of the skepticism, there were things that he just could not shake. And this is what he said, and like I said, it's on his gravestone. He says, "Two things fill the mind with ever new and increasing admiration and awe, the more often and steadily reflection is occupied with them: the starry heaven above me and the moral law within me." For Kant, heaven and nature sang, and he couldn't shake it. Regardless of the skepticism that was around, he says, "There's just two things. I look up in the sky and I look at the heavens and it speaks to me. And then I look inside and I look at my conscience, the moral law within that we all seem to intuitively have, and I just can't shake it." He goes on later and says, "I see them before me, these two things, and connect them immediately with my own existence." The reason I share Kant's quote is, while it was in the 1700s, it sounds just like the psalmist in Psalm chapter 8. Even though time and culture separated these individuals so drastically, there's something that was a reality in the psalmist that was also an experience of Kant that I'm guessing is probably an experience of many of us. We look at the world above and the world around, and we look within, and we say, something is singing. Something is speaking to us. We're in Psalm 8 today, and in Psalm 8, it begins with these words from the psalmist where he says, "O Lord, how majestic is your name throughout the earth. Your majesty covers the heavens." He looks around and he sees the glory of God in everything he sees. His majesty, his glory, it's out there. It's visible. It's evident. And he follows it up with these next verses in chapter 3. "When I look at the heavens, the work of your fingers. Moon and the stars, you've set them in place. He looks at that great stuff and it causes him to look within. Man, I look at the heavens, I look at the moon, I look at the stars. What am I? What is man that you're mindful of him? What is the Son of Man? What is mankind that you even consider him? The starry heavens above, the moral law within, causes him to recognize there is a song out there. Heaven and nature sing. Have you ever experienced that? Have you looked at the starry heavens above or some piece of nature out there and experienced the word that Kant is describing, the word that the psalmist is describing? Awe. Awe is an experience, a reaction that causes you to recognize who you are in the vastness of everything. Say, wow, there's a song out there. There's a conductor, a creator. How am I supposed to respond to this? And yet, we recognize not everyone experiences that. Some people look at the heavens above, look at the world around them, and there's no awe. It doesn't sing. How do we handle those two distinctions? I mean, if it's you and I ask you, yeah, have you ever experienced that? You think of some of the places just in our country alone where you might have been and said, man, this is amazing. There's one really clever person that has made a good income off of taking different like travel reviews of national parks where people look at them and say, eh, not impressed. They made these posters out of them. So for example, I know for my wife and I, one of the places we've been to that was just so impressive, it's Grand Canyon. You ever been there? You look out at it and you're just like, wow, this is amazing. It makes me feel small. That's all. Other people, so much. Look at this review left by someone. Grand Canyon, a hole. A very, very large hole. Not impressed. Yeah, I've never been there, but if you've ever seen the pictures in Yellowstone of the Grand Prismatic Springs, it's this geyser or watery area. I don't even know really what it is, but it's all these different colors, and it's otherworldly. It's amazing. And I just picture the frontiersmen walking through the West, all of the things they had to go through, and then coming upon that and thinking, oh my gosh, it's like I've entered another world. That's not everyone's experience. Look at this review. Save yourself some money, boil some water at home. No awe. Heaven and nature do not sing. We're just at Yosemite. Yosemite is beautiful. You've heard of a guy named Ansel Adams? I mean, he made his living just off of taking black and white photos of Yosemite. It's so incredible. It's so beautiful. Really was part of the initiation of our whole parks system because they said, this has got to be preserved. And then one person visited and he said, trees block view and there are too many gray rocks. We laugh because it just seems silly. How can you not look at those? What's wrong that we don't experience awe, that we don't hear the music? And of course, the problem is if we don't hear the music, we don't respond to the conductor. I want to tell you a story of two Francises. The first is a man named Francis Crick. Francis Crick was a genius, and we owe a lot to Francis Crick and his contribution to society. He helped develop. He helped give us an understanding for the structure of DNA. And so he and his partner, James Watson, were awarded the Nobel Prize. And at one level, if you read anything from Francis Crick, you'll understand he has a sense of wonder about the human body. And he even says that we have a deep need to know why we are here. What is the world made of? More important, what are we made of? He recognizes the questions exist. He recognizes there's something spectacular about it. But he doesn't see that it's a song. It's not communicating anything from anyone. This is what he said, too. He said, in the past, when it comes to these important questions, in the past, religion answered these questions, often in considerable detail. Now we know that almost all these answers are highly likely to be nonsense, having sprung from man's ignorance and his enormous capacity for self-deception. For Francis Crick, no awe, at least not one that comes from a songwriter. There's another Francis. His name is Francis Collins. And he too was successful. And he too we owe a lot to in our world. And he also made his living in many ways off of DNA as well. He helped map the Human Genome Project. And just like Francis Crick, he was agnostic spiritually in his life. But as he started his career in medicine, one of the things that shook him was as he would go on visits, and he would visit patients who were dying, and he would visit those who were Christian in their peace as they prepared and faced death was jarring to him. And then he shares that ultimately, on a trip to the Cascade Mountains, looking at a frozen waterfall, he finally chose to give his life to Christ. He experienced awe. Heaven and nature sang. And he recognized, as a result, he had to respond. And I think for all of us, we look at these two Francises and we recognize both of them extremely intelligent. And yet they come in very different conclusions. And I think the question for you today is, what conclusion will you draw from the starry heavens above and the moral law within? Is it a song? Do heaven and nature sing? Or is it just noise? And if heaven and nature do sing, what do we owe to the conductor? The psalmist recognized this question, and he answered in the affirmative. Yes, heaven and nature do sing. And he also followed with not just recognizing that it was a song outside, but it caused him, like Kant said, to look within. He asked this question. I look at the stars, I look at the heavens, and I ask, what is mankind that you even consider us? He looks within and he recognizes you have made us a little lower than the heavenly beings. You have crowned us with glory and honor. When I see the stars above and I look within, I recognize we are made special. The stars sing and tell me it. The conscience within me tells me it. We are crowned with glory and honor. The reason he says that is not just because some intuition, but because that is the story that has been revealed all the way back in Genesis 1, that mankind was made special. Again, some people can look at the stars above and the law within and say, there's no law within. Whatever internal things we might experience, it just happens to be conditioning of somehow, chance. It's not from a song. Take, for example, this author, when he was speaking at a TED Talk, his name is Yuval Harari, author of this book, Sapiens. He looks at stars above, the law within, says no song. It's all a figment of our imagination. In the same way God is, and because God is, nothing else is a song either. He says these words. He says, human rights are just like heaven and like God. It's just a fictional story that we've invented and spread around. It may be a very nice story. It may be a very attractive story. We want to believe it, but it's just a story. It's not a reality. It's not a biological reality. Just as jellyfish and woodpeckers and ostriches have no rights, Homo sapiens have no rights also. Take a human, cut them open, look inside. You find their blood. You find the heart and lungs and kidneys. But you do not find any rights. The only place you find rights is in the fictional stories that humans have invented and spread around. It's interesting that if you look so often and are unable to see a song out there, typically won't see a song in here. And there's a sense in which Yuval has a point. If there's no song out there and there's no song in here, meaning there's no songwriter, we're all just making it up. Where does the song come from? For Yuval, nowhere. As a result, nothing. Notice the transition he makes. If it's not a biological reality, it's not a reality. There's no singer. And just think, if that's the case, how many things then also are not real? When there's no songwriter. And go back to Francis Crick, the scientist who said there's no song. This is what he, in an interview in 1978, this is what he said. No newborn infant should be declared human until it has passed certain tests regarding its genetic endowment, and that if it fails these tests, it forfeits the right to live. If that sounds jarring or disturbing, that's the sound of shutting out the song of heaven and nature. That's the sound of acknowledging that nothing sings. And some might say, hey, you're taking extreme examples with Yuval Harari and Francis Crick, but don't really think that's entirely the case. In many ways, we're looking at people who are jumping to some logical conclusions. And then take, for instance, a man named Tom Holland. Tom Holland is a historian. He was not a Christian in the traditional sense. But he recognizes the same things that Yuval Harari are saying, and even that Francis Crick is saying. That if there is a reality, if there is a story, that's one thing. But if we have to say the story is biological, we're in a mess. And we can't just assume that we're going to come to an understanding of human rights on our own. He spent a long time studying Roman history, wrote some books on the Roman world. And then he decided to do a project and write on the Christian world, the advent of Christianity. And what he recognized is that so often the things today that we take as just common sense, it's just natural that these human rights exist. He recognized there's nothing natural about it. This is not something that people naturally draw a conclusion from. You can look at all kinds of different civilizations and societies. human rights emerge out of a story. They don't just happen. And the problem is, the story that these human rights have emerged from, the Christian story, has been a 2,000-year-old story that we just take for granted. And we don't recognize the ways in which this story has shaped our world. And he began to realize the power and the transformative nature of the Christian story. The Christian story through Jesus Christ that recognized what was spoken of in the Old Testament, what was spoken of in Psalm 8, that mankind is made in the image of God, that he's been crowned with glory and honor. And as a result, with the advent of Christianity, society's changed. Human rights emerged out of it. He says this in one interview. He says, because the West has been so hegemonic for so long, it's been in a position to assume that its concept of human rights is universal. They don't need to think about it. Of course human rights exist. But what the rise of China and other civilizational powers is doing is to remind us that the concept of human rights is one that has emerged in a very specific cultural matrix, which is a Christian one. Therefore, if you want to believe in human rights, you have to believe. It takes a leap of faith to believe that there are things called human rights, just as much as it takes a leap of faith to believe that the Lord Jesus Christ rose from the dead. They're both beliefs, and the fact that most people in the West sign up to the fact that human rights exist and they're important, and that they should determine public policy. Actually, it's as rooted in theology and myth and metaphysics as all the teachings of Christianity. And I think once people are reminded of that, I think it becomes impossible not to feel a greater sense of what Christianity is about. If you believe in human rights, why not believe that Jesus rose from the dead? In some sense, what he's saying is the problem with Yuval Harari's statement is the only things that can be true are those things that can be proved biologically. Then we're in a heap of trouble. But what he's saying is, yeah, human rights, they're true. But the only way we can say they're true is if they come from something outside of us. And what we see is that they came from the Christian story. So you have to believe it. It is a leap of faith because you can't cut open a human and see human rights in there. But is there something inside of you that tells you it's true? Do heaven and nature sing and you recognize, regardless of whether or not I can find it in a microscope, I know it's true. And if you know it's true and you believe that it's true, even though you can't prove it, why not believe in the resurrection? That's what he's saying. It's just as enchanting as a story. It might be metaphysical, but it doesn't mean it's not reality. And the thing that the psalmist is reminding us of is that heaven and nature sing, and they tell us that there's something special about us. And as a result, we need to act in a certain way. In many ways, people see Psalm 8 as a commentary of Genesis 1. Crowned with glory and honor, and then it lists the ways that mankind has been given all of these responsibilities. It's talking about how we are made in God's image. And what does that mean? What does it mean to be made in God's image? People have really wrestled with how we are to understand what that means. This is, for a long time, people thought to be made in God's image, it's talking about our substance. And many people thought even kind of narrowing down a little bit more about our rationality. Others said, no, it's more about how we were created for relationship, about our relationality. We were made to be in relationship with God. And we are made to be in relationship with others. It's about our relational nature. It sets us apart. It makes us distinct. Others think, no, it's not a noun. It's a verb. It's about what we do. You look in Genesis, when it talks about the image of God, it immediately goes into what they are supposed to do, have dominion and be fruitful and multiply. And you look in Psalm 8, again, it goes talks about having dominion over these things. It's about our function. It's about what we do. And I think in many ways, all of those key in on different aspects of what we talk about when we talk about being in the image of God. The reason they're all so popular is because we can see some of those things in each of us. But I think they fall short on their own. And the reason is because if image of God is narrowed down to our rationality or something that we manifest, there's some people that don't possess that, whether it's infants, whether it's the end of life, dementia, comatose state, we want to say they're in the image of God still. Even things like relationality. Relationships can almost be a spectrum too, right? Some people are much more highly relational than others. And again, look at a child in a womb. Not relational really yet. I think we want to say, so made in the image of God. Or when we talk about function, I think the functions are true. Wherever you see image of God, you see them doing. But again, what happens when we're not functioning? Still in the image of God. But I think rather the function is what we do as a result of who we are. You think of the psalm, it says, crowned with glory and honor. And you look in Psalms 1, and you see this language that's filled with royalty. And I think what we see is to be in the image of God is to be a status that is attributed to us by God. It's not something that we can earn, maintain, or lose. What you see throughout Scripture, whether it's in Genesis 9 or whether it's in James 3, is even after the fall of mankind, where sin has entered the world, it still says we're in the image of God. And so the image of God is not something we can earn or maintain or possess. It is something that is decreed by God. He finds us of worth. He sees us as royal sons and royal daughters in our being, in our decree. So we can say, like Dr. Seuss, an image bearer is an image bearer, no matter how small, no matter how old, no matter how debilitated, no matter how impacted by the difficulties of this world. Each person bears the mark of royalty. They possess the image of God because the song is not just the instrumental. At this point now, the melody has come through, the lyrics have come through, the words have come through the song, and the words are, you are royalty. And without the lyrics, we're left wondering, seeing, there's a song, I know what it's there, but I really don't know the substance of what it means or who I am or what makes me significant. But the psalmist tells us, here's the lyrics to the song. You have been crowned with glory and honor, every single one of us. But then I have to be honest, sometimes I'm around people who have been crowned with glory and honor. And I think, oh man, I thought royalty would be easier to be around. As, for example, one day, and I say this with a long record of not being a hypochondriac. I'm going through Heinen's, and there's this guy shopping for jalapenos, and he's picking up a jalapeno, and he's sniffing it, and then he's putting it back and picking up another one. Now, hear what I'm saying. He's not just sniffing it. Have you ever seen the crime shows with like the missing person and the bloodhound, and they take the clothes and just rub it up in his nose? That's what this guy's doing with the jalapenos. And he's rubbing it, and then he's putting it back, and I'm thinking, just buy a bunch. What are they, a quarter? Like, don't put them back. What's wrong with people? And I go to the Y, and I just wanted to relax. I've been shoveling snow. Wanted to go in the hot tub and relax. So I go into the hot tub. and there's this guy in the hot tub. And he's been in there for who knows how long, but he's worked up a sweat in that hot tub. And he's taking water, and he's splashing it in his face, and he's rubbing it down. And every time he splashes and rubs, he spits. And I'm thinking, you're over there, I'm over here, but still, man, come on. Like, you don't need to spit in the water. Then another guy comes in, and he takes a jet. Another guy comes in, and he says, he's talking to the guy, saying, oh, do you want this jet? The guy walks over towards me and says, I don't care about a jet. I'm just here trying to sweat out a cold. Really? You're going to tell me? You're going to announce this? Like, if you want to sweat out a cold, take a hot bath at home. Don't come in here with all of us. And you just walk through and you think, what is wrong with people? Really? Made in the image of God, crowned with glory and honor? But then we have to remind ourselves, their status is not based off of what they do, how clean they are. And the truth is, honestly, the problem's not with them. The problem's with me. They're messing up my kingdom. In the danger of living in a world where people are quirky and people are broken and people do sin and people do wrong us and there's all kinds of things under the sun, that we recognize, yes, justice must be done, and there is evil in the world, and all of those things. I'm talking about just the annoying things that get under our skin. The exercise we have to go through, I think, is to remind ourselves they are a thou, not an it. And the danger is if people get in my skin and people annoy me and they start to interfere with my kingdom, like, how dare someone else be in a hot tub in this public area? Don't they know I want it all to myself? When I start to do that, it affects me because it hinders my ability to see the image of God in them. And the psalmist should remind us that when heaven and nature sings and we look at the stars above and the law within and we recognize there's something significant about us, we need to know there's something significant about all of us. And then I think we're left saying, well, how in the world can I move forward in this? How am I supposed to do that? And then I think we're reminded of this song and the words that go before it. Joy to the Lord. The Lord has come. Let earth receive her King. Because what we see at Christmas and what we see in the coming of the Lord is the image of God par excellence. He came to demonstrate to us how we are to function as image bearers, what it means to reflect God to a watching world. And he did on our behalf what we could not do. And he also entered into the world so we can say, okay, there's a song, and I can hear the instruments, but I wish I had the lyrics. I wish I had the words. And John says, the word became flesh. The lyrics manifest itself among us. And now we know the song that's been in our hearts, what that reality is, and how we are supposed to live. Look at these words in Colossians. It says, Paul writes, he is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he is the head, the body of the church. He's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of the cross. You think of Jesus coming, taking on flesh, giving us the lyrics of the song. And the question you're left with is the question we had in the beginning. Do you think heaven and nature sing? Have you heard the song And do you know the lyrics? If it's singing in you through the heavens, if it's singing through you through the moral law and human rights, just consider what Tom Holland said. If you believe in human rights, why not believe that Jesus rose from the grave? Will you pray with me? Lord, I want to acknowledge that each of us have a choice before us. We can be like Francis Crick, and we can say, doesn't sing, no song. Or we can look like Francis Collins did, the heavens above, like Kant did at the law within, and recognize there is a song. If there's a song, there's a songwriter. And that songwriter tells us that we are crowned with glory and honor, that we are made in his image, and we are to know him, to trust him, and to reflect him to the world. May we respond accordingly. In your name we pray. Amen.